Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 266 for Monday, September 26th, 2016. Marquez Brownlee. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hello and welcome to Triangulation. I'm Jason Howell, obviously not Leo Laporte. Leo Laporte is still gallivanting around the world. This is the show where we talk with some of the most important people in technology. We just kind of sit them down one-on-one, ask them all sorts of questions about their life, what brought them to where they are now, essentially, and why technology is just such a fun space to be in and to live in. We're all here for a number of different reasons, and we all have different paths. So this is a show where we kind of dissect that a little bit and see how everybody ends up where they are. This week, I don't know, I'm super, super thrilled to welcome Marquez Brownlee to Triangulation. I'm a huge fan of his work, huge fan of your work, Marquez. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. So, Marquez, for those who have been living under a rock that has nothing to do with YouTube, is one of the, I would say you're probably one of the most dominant kind of technology faces and voices on YouTube, and have been for a decent amount of time now. At least, I mean, definitely your subscriber count just keeps on going up. Right now you're at 3.75 million on YouTube. How does that feel? Yeah.
It's awesome. It's fun to know that so many people also want to see what I want to make. So yeah, that's encouraging to keep making and keep talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. So we'll start off right at the top here with kind of pointing out the obvious. And I asked the show's kind of producers, people who've been involved with Triangulation for the last little while, to confirm this. And Tony Wang here at TWiT did confirm that you are the youngest person ever to be featured as a guest on Triangulation. You're 22 years old. And okay. Normally, I only point that out because this show, Triangulation, has featured people who have like a long life career, let's say, in technology. Right. You know, they've worked at Apple for 20 years or whatever their path is. It always kind of includes years and years and years of experience. Now, you have years of experience doing what you do. It's just that you started out so young when you began. How old were you when you realized you had this affinity for technology?
Oh, for technology, I guess a little before I started YouTube. I mean, obviously, I didn't start YouTube when YouTube started, but it was 7 years of having a channel. And then before that, I kind of have vague memories of like walking around the house with a camcorder, just like recording random objects, just because like it looked cool to like make a video of something.
Yeah.
Something weird about that was fun to me. I'm sure before that there was other little nuggets of technology, but I feel like that was where I got into video. And yeah, just the starting when I was like a preteen and like an early teenager, that kind of stuff, obviously made it really easy to get into it.
For sure, for sure. And technology, I mean, at that point, like I remember when I was a kid, my parents had a camcorder. And I mean, if I was going to, and I was way into video as well, if I was going to do it, like it wasn't nearly as easy and compact and straightforward and inexpensive as it is now. And as I'm imagining it probably was when you were a little bit younger, it required this gigantic, shoulder mounted camcorder in order to do it. I had to convince them in order to do it. It sounds like your parents were pretty kind of forthcoming when it came to technology and access to their technology and giving you what you wanted in that space.
Right. Yeah, I was. So the camera was their camera, and obviously that was fun to be able to use that. My dad's always had a job in tech, so that was obviously also really encouraging, and that helped me get exposed to it. And sure. So he's a tech savvy guy. My mom's not necessarily the most tech savvy person, but yeah, they made it pretty accessible pretty quickly.
Yeah, your dad worked in IT when you were younger. Did he? I don't know. How did he kind of share his life in IT with you? Did he bring you into kind of any of the really geeky behind the scenes stuff that he was doing for his job?
Not really. It was actually just more of like when he come home and he was he was into like the phone he used. He went through like he was from the BlackBerry days. Like he was really into getting like the next BlackBerry, and he would go ham with that kind of stuff. And the computer that he used at home and stuff like that. So when he came home from work, it was more tech that I got to check out and that he got to explore.
Yeah, right. I don't know, if I were to ask your parents, let's say, when they first saw that kind of light bulb, that passion that you had for technology at a young age, what do you think they would say? What do you think their answer would be? Is there like a key, like a marquee moment when you were young where you kind of switched?
I would guess that they would point to when I was walking around with the camcorder. A little bit after that was when I started like making these tutorials, and that was 2009 when I started making videos, so that might also be what they point to. But yeah, I feel like the walking around with a camera just randomly making videos of things was probably the initial thing that they would point to.
Yeah, and I remember like in some of the stuff that I've been reading, it's pretty much just you and a camera and the things that you have around you. I think some of your biggest kind of tips to share with people is take what you already have access to and make something around that. Is that more difficult to do nowadays? I feel like everything's so much more mature that that's a great starting point, but you know, a certain number of people are going to rise to the top in that regard.
Yeah, I think it's more and less. It's more accessible because like you said, the camera is so much smaller. You have a camera on your phone right now. You can just make a video today and put it online and you have a channel already. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like visibility or differentiating yourself, then yeah, you could see it as the opposite way where it's evolved so much that the barrier to entry seems higher because everything is so polished and everything is so clean already that it's hard to make something that lives up to it on your first try, but you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to make something on your first try that looks like the best stuff out there. Because when I started, all my stuff looked nothing like what the best stuff at that time looked like. So it's always this spectrum of wherever you end up on it, it's just kind of your own style. You don't have to emulate anyone. Just get a camera and make something and then develop it from there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if the path was easy for everyone, then I mean, no one would stand out. Everybody would be on the same level playing field. And I don't know, there wouldn't be anything special about that if there wasn't a little bit of kind of give and take to get there, I suppose, learning along the way.
Yeah.
What was some of your favorite technology before? And I'm talking kind of like when you were young, when you were before you were doing a show. What kind of stands out as some of your favorite kind of technology stuff, right? As a kid, stuff you got really excited about.
Before I made my channel, one of the first pieces of tech that I saved up for a while to get and then bought with my own money. This is when I was in high school, so it's a little before I started my channel. But it was the first generation iPod Touch. So I was listening to music, and this was when I had like a tape recorder, a tape player, and headphones to that. So I was like, this is it. I need to get an iPod. This is the one. So it got announced. I was really psyched about it. I was saved up for a while. I knew it was what I wanted. So like I was like, all right, I want to do it. So they were like, all right, okay, you can do this. Took me to the Apple store, paid my own money, unboxed it, and I was like super psyched, put all my music on it. I went in, I was going to make it like my main, because I didn't have a smartphone either. So I was like, all right, my alarm's going there, my notes going here, my email, everything is going in here. And so that was like when I got super into like a single device, and that was a lot of fun. It got stolen at school like 2 weeks later, so that was pretty miserable. But it was definitely one of the first devices that I think got me super psyched. I think after that, it was a laptop that I bought. That was for school, so obviously I had to have good reasons to pick that one over others. But yeah, that's pretty much the beginnings of like the new device stuff that I really started to look into. It was like that iPod Touch sort of got it started.
Were you at a young age, were you kind of a fan of Apple products? Like, did Apple speak to you to a certain degree that other technology did not?
A little bit. I think the original iPhone came out before that, and I was on Verizon. So I had a regular flip phone for a while, and then right a little after that came out, the LG Voyager.
The Voyager
came
out.
Mm-hmm. And I got that because I was on Verizon. I couldn't get an iPhone. So I was like, I look at the iPhone. It looks really cool. I got the iPod Touch, which is very similar to an iPhone, and I'm into that. So obviously, yeah, I have a bit of that ecosystem in me. And then I think my first phone after the Voyager was the Moto Droid, which was kind of like the anti-iPhone at the time, but that was also a Verizon thing. But I guess, yeah, Apple did have its place with that iPod and the iPhone a little bit before I got into smartphones, yeah.
I completely forgot about the LG Voyager, man. I had that too. I only just now, like I had heard that that was your first smartphone. I just didn't do a search for it. And now pulling it up, I'm like, whoa, that was mine right before the Motorola Droid as well. The Droid being the first Android for me.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That was great.
Want to hear how I broke it?
What's that?
Want to hear how I broke it?
The LG Voyager?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's one of only two phones I've ever dropped that broke as a result of the drop. I got out of a taxi in New York City, and it's this clamshell phone or whatever. Yeah. So in one very graceful motion, phones kind of tend to slide out your pocket. I stepped out of the cab, it landed on the curb, and I stepped on it and snapped it backwards over the curb, all in one very impressive move that I couldn't even duplicate today if I tried. Broke it right.
That's painful. That hurts. Yeah. Although, in retrospect, must have been kind of satisfying, unless you actually really loved the phone. I'm sure it was depressing at the time. But
I had it for a while, but yeah, it was pretty sad.
I only asked this because over the weekend I had the Huawei Honor 8, and it slipped out of my pocket, and sure enough, it cracked the glass on the back. Do you drop a lot of devices? I mean, you're playing with devices all the time. I have to imagine. It just happens, right?
I mean, yeah, I've had the device like slide out my pocket in a car or slide out my pocket and like onto a carpet or something. The only one I've ever dropped and broken is the first Moto X, which I dropped after I reviewed it. So
good.
For all the devices and things that I do play with, like you're right, there's a lot of tech that gets through my hands, but none of it's actually broken. So that's pretty awesome.
I don't know what you're doing differently than I am. I think my pockets are just too shallow or something.
Something about that.
Yeah, it really is. You know, do they hang down or do they whatever? So also, when you were younger before and now, you know, obviously this is a big deal, continues to be a big deal. Ultimate Frisbee. You got into Ultimate Frisbee in the eighth grade. And I believe this is before you, or maybe it's concurrently, right about the time you started doing video. Did they happen about the same time?
Ultimate was definitely before it. So okay. I started playing Ultimate right before high school. And I was a couple of years into that, and I started my channel like somewhere around the middle of high school. But yeah, I've been playing since right before I knew I wanted to play on my high school's team. I knew they had a team before I went as a freshman. I tried out immediately as a freshman. They had a varsity team and a JV team. So I played for the JV team my freshman and sophomore year, and then I played for the varsity team my junior and senior year.
Wow. That is super cool. And so, of course, I mean, these are, you know, the earlier days. Now you're playing for the New York Rumble. It's the Major League Ultimate. So you're also on top of being a super successful YouTube tech reviewer. You are a professional Ultimate Frisbee player. That is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. The sport is still relatively young. I mean, it started... Fun fact, at the high school I went to in the 1960s, so it's a less than 50-year-old sport as of right now, but it's kind of like where I see lacrosse a couple years ago, where people are starting to hear of it. They see it once in a while on SportsCenter. They realize that athletes are playing it, and it's really fun to watch. So I think that's going to be something a lot of people figure out about pretty soon.
And you were named, by the way, Defensive Player of the Year for your conference, so congratulations. That was this year. That was actually just a couple of months ago.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's awesome. So, so you're doing these two pretty incredible things. Most people would hope to do just one very incredible path, but you know, you're following two awesome paths. How do they play off of each other? I mean, you know, it's got to take a lot of time out of your life to devote to be good at both at the level that you are. Are they complementary in any ways?
That's a good question. I don't know if they're complementary. They're definitely both pretty rooted in hard work. But for the most part, as far as time management goes, it's like Ultimate is like a weekends thing. Every weekend, Saturday and Sunday, including this past weekend, it's like two completely full days of playing, whether it's tournament play or whatever we're doing. And then when I was in school, it was also like the Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning practices. So you get up early. So I guess that whole discipline sort of makes you more focused, and whatever you want to say, being an athlete can help you outside of the field. But I can't think of like a direct tie between the two, but they're definitely both things I enjoy.
Yeah, like I have to imagine, I mean, if I was to think about what it, well, I think this is basically what you said. If I was to think about what it takes in order to be good at both, it takes discipline and it takes focus. And so, you know, possibly being good at one in that regard sharpens those tools for the other, and they work side by side. That's just really impressive.
Yeah.
So then kind of moving into the world of YouTube, you got your first video. Everybody always talks about your first video, of course, because that's an obvious place to start, right? You're 15 years old. You put your first video up on YouTube. It was a review of the HP Pavilion DV17 Media Center remote. What pushed you to do this? Like, you just knew that a platform called YouTube existed, and you're like, I want to put video out there. Let's do this thing right here.
Yeah, so for a little bit before I made that first video, I had this other little channel. I don't even remember what it's called, but I don't know if it was the same channel, but I uploaded these random videos of like indoor soccer, of like, you know, just critique what I was doing, see if anyone cared and would comment on improvements I could make, just to use the internet as a mass crowdsourcing version of like a coach watching you play.
Yeah.
And then I was like, all right, that's dumb. It got deleted. And then later, I came back to that channel and I was like, YouTube is still pretty interesting. And at that point, it would take me like lots of watching all these videos to decide which laptop to buy. So I'd watched, you know, the two or three videos on like CNET's YouTube channel about HP laptops, and then a couple other laptops on other various channels I'd found, all of it on YouTube, to make my decision. So I come back around to actually buying the laptop, and now I'm kind of in this unique position where I own the laptop and not many people are also talking about it. So maybe I can share, if someone's in the same position, they want to buy a laptop, they'll have more information to choose from by knowing about this one. So I was like, all right, I'll make a video about this little remote that comes in the PCI slot. I'll make a video about the software that comes on it. I'll make a video about the screen, the keyboard, the accessories, the cooler I bought for it, all these sorts of things. So you can basically put yourself in my shoes like you already own it, see if you like it or not. So that's why I made that video and like the next 70 videos for those things related to the laptop.
How does it feel to go back and watch that now? I mean, obviously, times have changed a lot.
Yes, times have changed, but the intention is still there. It's still to put yourself in the buyer's shoes. You've already bought something and now you're experiencing using it instead of just thinking about what it might be like.
Yeah. Do you, like, I know if I go back, you know, when I was a kid, I did a lot of like audio and video recording and everything. And to go back, like, I recognize the importance of it because it helped kind of pave the road that I traveled. But then at the same time, I have this tinge of like embarrassment from witnessing me in that insecure time of my life. Do you feel that when you watch these videos?
Not only the first video, but like anything more than like 3 weeks old, I feel like that. Because I feel like the latest version of yourself is always the most savvy version of yourself versus what you were doing in the past. So even things that were your best possible work 4 months ago, you may look back at that and be like, oh, why didn't I think of this other thing I should have been doing? Or why did I make that mistake? Or why did I not light this or color this way? Blah, blah, blah. So, I do definitely look back and feel like, you know, I don't regret any of it. I'm glad I did it and I wouldn't change it for a thing. But yeah, there's definitely the embarrassment of looking at your older self.
For sure.
Your younger self.
I mean, you're your own best critic. And if you're looking back even 3 or 4 months ago on videos that, you know, you can find the ways that you would improve those. I mean, that's basically how you hone your craft. So that's how you continue to get better. How did your parents feel about knowing that you were throwing these videos out onto on the wild web, let's say? Did they know at first? Like, did they understand kind of what you were doing with those videos?
As far as I know, they didn't really know what it was all about. Like, they kind of were like one day, like, hey, like, we've seen like the videos that you're doing online, like on your channel. Just keep it up, I guess. It looks cool. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a way of encouraging like a hobby or something like that. But As far as it being online, like they've always have, you know, they want it to be safe and they don't want anyone, they don't, oh, don't put the front door in the video. Don't put our address in the video or anything like that. But, you know, just general safety. But other than that, just do your thing.
That's cool. What was your setup like? I know you've got a crazy setup now. And I think I saw that you were really dedicated to kind of the laptop environment for quite a while. Why was that?
Because that was the only machine I had.
Because
so
it's what you have.
Yeah. So a lot of the research, again, before I bought the laptop was, is this for school? So I need to be able to like take it to school, take notes on it, take it home, do work as a like a, my main computer as a desktop. So I bought a 17-inch laptop. It was a desktop replacement. That's the whole category of what it was called. So yeah, I had like a couple. It started small. It was like, oh, I put it on a cooler, and then it was, oh, I'll get a bigger cooler with USB ports powering it. And then I get a cooler with USB ports and a mic and a laptop stand and another monitor and a mouse and a keyboard. And it just became this whole thing, this whole system that I kind of just took it home to and plugged it into. And it was a desktop at that point. So it was kind of fun to switch back and forth. But that's the reason I got it is for it to be good at that. So it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. And I have to imagine, I mean, based on kind of your philosophy of reviewing what you had, every step of the way, you're picking up this new gear to add to your spread. That's more ammo for reviews and how-tos and in-depth dives and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. If I'm doing a video on a desktop replacement and I find a new mouse that I like and someone else is also buying a desktop replacement and they're trying to pick a mouse, now I get to make a video about the mouse. I get to show you what's good with it.
Yeah. Excellent. Were you, and I know your YouTube channel says Marques Brownlee, but everybody knows you as Marques Brownlee, but they also know you as MKBHD. Were you MKBHD from the beginning as well, or at what point along the span did that happen?
So that happened a couple hundred videos in when I realized that I should probably, so it was this sort of an SEO decision where I wanted people who were watching the videos to realize that there were other videos on the channel that maybe they wanted to subscribe to. So at this point, like I would start every single video with like, hey, what's up, guys? Let's get right into it. And I just get into the video. But I wanted to, you know, show people there's other videos on the channel. So, hey, guys, it's Marques Brownlee here back with another HD tutorial. Today we're going to be going over blah, blah, blah. So it was this really long sentence. What's up, guys? Marques Brownlee here, back with another high-definition video tutorial about. So I don't want to open every video with this huge thing. So I think that was around the time that Twitter came out. Twitter, everyone was making a Twitter. I didn't have a Twitter for a while. Someone took Marques Brownlee before I even made a Twitter. So I needed a shorter, just a Twitter handle to finally sign up for Twitter. So I made it MKBHD. And it was a little bit after that that I started introing these videos with a shorter and shorter version of that previous sentence where I'd say, hey, what's up, guys? MKBHD here. And let's get into it. So you kind of could go back and find other MKBHD videos that way.
And MKB, by the way, I love that your thought into this whole process. Like you can definitely tell you've thought about this stuff a lot, probably more than I think a lot of people who just end up deciding, oh, well, I'm going to put some stuff out on YouTube. Like you actually think about why it matters to make a comment about, you know, other videos or something along those lines to kind of drop clues, drop hints to the people who are watching your shows. And that's super smart and probably a big reason why you've been such a success on YouTube. MKB, I think, is your initials and then HD for high definition. Are you are you willing to tell anyone what the K stands for?
Not really.
This is a secret you're going to take forever, isn't it? You're never going to let people know.
So what I say is if you guess it, I will say, I'll tell you, yes, you guessed it. And then people guess like three or four and they either get it in the first few or they never get it. So I don't hold it back if you do guess it, but it's, I'll never actually just be like, oh yes, here's what it is.
Crispy with a K.
No.
Kent.
No.
No. Jammer B, you got one?
Like three or four, and then it's like, I don't know any others. They exhaust their resources.
I'm not going to take up the entire show throwing out names, so I guess we'll just leave it up to people to guess for themselves. You also, let's see here, you have a lot of equipment, not just the equipment that you're editing with, but kind of the cameras and stuff, your camera nut, right? And you've really gotten into the cameras. Was that a fascination that started with the cameras that you were borrowing from your parents? Or did that kind of, it seems to have moved into another level, I guess is where I'm getting at, where as before it was like a camera was required to put stuff onto YouTube. Now it's, I really like these cameras for all these reasons, and they're super expensive and they're amazing. Like, where does that fascination come from?
Yeah, so there was the tape cameras, that was fun. And then I started the channel with just the webcam on my laptop, on that laptop I bought.
Right.
So when I went and unboxed the cooler, that was a video I did, I unboxed the cooler. I was literally taking the laptop and like turning it and like pointing the monitor down so it was pointed over at the counter over there, and then I would unbox it using the webcam's recording software. Did tons of videos like that. And I wanted to not have to do that to record other hardware videos. So like 100 something tutorials later, I'm trying to get a camera. And so I got this Sanyo Zacti CG10. Super glad I got that camera, because that camera had a really great close focus distance. It was a really great macro mode, had very fast autofocus, had a decent microphone, had a flip out swiveling LCD, had just enough inputs for me to be learning about it as I got along. So it was like a really great starter camera. Got a little GorillaPod for it, and I was shooting videos trying to get creative with that. But also the thing is, it's my number one goal, even with the cameras today that I'm using to shoot, is I want the video to be as realistic looking as possible as I can put on the internet, on YouTube. So that's the idea of that, is to get you to feel like you're holding the product, or to feel like you're there, like you're with me, or you're with the product. So future cameras past that point where I went from that Sanyo camera to the Canon T2i, which was, you know, DSLR. So now it's getting into like interchangeable lenses. So I'm learning more about that. I'm learning more about remote shooting, more about raw shooting. And of course, it has way better photography modes. So all this stuff comes with that new camera. I moved from that to, let's see, the Canon 60D. From that to the Canon 5D Mark III, I think. 5D Mark III. All of these being Canon DSLR, so all of them very similar in their function, just with different capabilities. Number five was the Canon C100, which is a cine camera. So it's a little bit of a next level camera, but it's made specifically for video. And I moved to that. I'm sorry if I'm nerding out right now, but I moved from the DSLR because I was doing so many things to the 5D to make it better at video, you know, adding an external monitor, adding a handle, adding a battery for the battery grip, adding all these things, switching the cinema profiles on the camera. All these things are just taken care of in a cine camera. It's all built in. The swiveling LCD is built in. The audio jack, the microphones, everything is handled. So I switched to the C100. C100 was a great camera. And that was probably my favorite camera of all time, because that camera had amazing color and was really good with autofocus, with manual stuff. And it was my first cine camera. And then from there, I rented a Red Scarlett randomly just because I wanted to shoot with it, because I was thinking about 4K a lot. And the C100 was a 1080p camera. So that Scarlett was obviously a raw video camera as well. You learn about raw photos with all the DSLRs, but now there's raw video with this Red camera. And it's a cine camera, and it's not really meant for one person shooting. And as many videos as you watch comparing the Red Scarlett with the C100, everyone tends to recommend the C100 for solo running gun documentary shooting. But when I shot with the Scarlett and I got that footage back in and I imported it, I have to get this camera. I have to. It's great. It looks great, and it's raw, and I can change all the metadata. Everything was awesome about it. So a couple months later, I bought a Red Scarlett, and I've been with Red cameras ever since. So Red Scarlett MX, Red Epic MX, Red Epic Dragon, Red Weapon Dragon, Red Helium Weapon, and then et cetera. So that's where I'm at right now.
So you've pretty much jumped through the entire Red category, essentially. 4K cameras, basically.
Yeah, there's kind of a ladder of like their product line, and I feel like the Scarlett's kind of a teaser to the rest of it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to dive in there. Yeah.
And I mean, these are cameras that, you know, filmmakers drool over. You know, so I'm fascinated by the fact that, like, when we think of, when I think of YouTube, and I think when a lot of people think of YouTube, they think of every, you know, the democratization of video for anyone to have access to the ability to reach a large audience by just recording something with what they have and putting it out there, which is totally true. You take it to this next level. I mean, and not just in shooting video for YouTube, you're shooting technology reviews, but they look so good. And I mean, a huge part of that, a huge reason for that, is because you start off with this excellent source, you know, this amazing camera. Obviously, it gets all kind of crunched down and compressed for YouTube, but the starting point is a really important part to the look of the video that you do. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty big differentiating factor. I think while the general idea about YouTube being super accessible to anyone is true, there's also different ways to stand out in different genres. I mean, there's all kinds of genres on YouTube. There's the makeup tutorials, there's the beauty vlogger, there's the everyday vlogger, there's the tech videos, there's all kinds of stuff, there's pranksters, whatever else you want to do. So for inside of my little tech video genre, if you expand that, there's also different differentiating factors as well. There's people whose personalities are amazing. There's people who do really great camera work or who are experts on certain pieces of tech like smartphones or tablets or whatever. And my thing was like, I'm like an everyday guy who's, I'm just picking up the phone and seeing what's cool with it and showing it to you. But also my, something that differentiated it was the footage was as clean and as realistic looking as possible.
Yeah.
So that was good for being different and also good for if you're trying to buy the product. It still really helps to be able to see it really clearly. And the camera helps a lot with that.
For sure. If you're in the market for a product, like, you know, how many times you go to a site and you want to get a close up, you want to dive into that product photo as close as you can to take a look, to get as close to, if you had it in your hand, to know kind of what the experience would be like or what the heck does that button say down there. And your videos show it all. They look awesome. So you mentioned in one of your, you have a couple of five facts for me about me videos on your channel, that at least up to the 100 video mark that you produced, you still only had 78 subscribers. And now, of course, you sit around 3.75 million and that continues to go up. I mean, every single day you could see that number jump dramatically. Where did you get the tenacity to kind of stick to it? Because I think a lot of people think about YouTube and success on YouTube and they think, well, I'm just going to, you know, record a couple of videos and it's going to find the right audience or whatever. But you're talking like 100 videos, which is a lot of content. And it's, you know, 78 subscribers up to that point. Did it matter to you that it was slow going, or were you just kind of so enthralled by the process that didn't really matter? You were just enjoying it along the way.
It was a little bit of both. It was the process, which is really interesting to me, of just making something, and each thing that I make can be a little bit better than the last thing, and each thing that I make talks to maybe one or two more people than the last. But to me, that growth was actually a lot. Even though it's exponential from that beginning, if you zoomed all the way in, was like, day one, 7 people watched the video. Mm-hmm. Day two, 9 people watched the video. 1 week later, 25 people watched every video. Now, hold on. It just doubled. Like, where did these new people come from? Like, they're all just watching this consistent stream of videos being uploaded, like, every day.
Yeah.
1 week later, 60 people are watching each thing I upload. So it's like, that's awesome. Like, so I was kind of thrilled with just seeing how many people were interested in the tech that I was talking about. And I guess talking about more wider varieties of tech and being consistent with the style and uploading frequently, it just kind of grew from there.
Yeah. All right, before we continue on, definitely want to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Epson. Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer does not use ink cartridges. Features an amazing innovative refillable ink tank that earned it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. So you're not going to be super frustrated anymore because you're running out of ink. It includes up to 2 years of ink equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. You can save up to 80% on ink with the low-cost replacement bottles. It's powered by Precision Core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver just an amazing combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you'll have the freedom to print without running out of ink. The Epson EcoTank system was actually named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. So if you want to check this out for yourself, I highly recommend you go to Epson.com/EcoTank today. It's going to transform the way your home, your office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, you want to turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support. All right, so we're speaking with Marques Brownlee. What is the site? It's youtube.com/isitmkbhd to get right there.
Yes. Every social site, it'll be /mkbhd.
Excellent. Yeah. And at MKBHD on Twitter. I mean, you're a monster everywhere, basically. 3.75 million on YouTube, 735,000 on Twitter, 516,000 on Instagram, blah, blah, blah. Hundreds of thousands everywhere, basically. So and what that shows is that you've done a really good job at engaging your audience, which is so important in creating online content and thriving on the internet today. How kind of instrumental have the audience of that follows your content and follows your videos, how much do they play into the content that you create?
A lot, actually. So in the beginning, in the first couple dozen weeks, I could actually literally talk to everyone who was watching the videos. So anytime anyone left a comment, I could reply. Anytime anyone had any feedback about the video, I could reply or learn from them. Anytime I used to actually get, there was email notifications that YouTube as a service would send anytime a new person subscribes, comments. I think you used to be able to add as a friend, but I don't think they do that anymore. But anytime someone would subscribe, I'll go to their channel, click the link from the email, and thank them for subscribing. So Wow. That it was at that point, like every single person I could talk to. From that it's growing, and obviously you can no longer talk to every single person, but you can still constantly interact with the names you recognize. You see people who are there more frequently. You see names that you recognize from previous comments on other videos. They can give feedback, and they're often the first people to watch each thing you make. So they kind of are ready for it and are ready to compare it to previous things. I think the most valuable audience to critique a video is people who have never seen any of your stuff before, because mm-hmm. they don't have any expectation, but they also don't have any like bar to cross, or just watching it with a clean slate just to see what's up. And so like people from like, if it gets linked somewhere on a website, so the comments on that site or on Reddit or something, and people comment on Reddit, then those comments are like people who have never seen it before. And they can be the most constructively critical to the style or to the content. And that actually helps the most. So I feel like a combination of all that, people who have never seen it before and people who watch everything you make, all of that, if you're engaging with them and you're learning from them, then that can help a lot.
It's pretty easy to spot the people that have not kind of been close to your content before that are making comments. To find that kind of constructive new voice.
Yeah, usually it would just be like people who aren't, like if you comment on the video in the first day, you're probably a subscriber. Like if you see it in your subscription box, you comment in the first 24 hours it's uploaded, then I'm assuming you've seen stuff before. But if you look, like if you like you see in the numbers of people who are finding the channel every day, a couple thousand people find the new channel every day. That means the next video I make will be the first new MKBHD video that 10,000 people are going to see for the first time. So that up here is like a little motivation to make this a little more special and a little better than the last one.
Right.
I feel like if I read the comments, for the most part, I kind of know who's been around and who's watched a lot of videos, and they're just happy to see a new one. And then like 2 or 3 days later, if you go back to a video, you'll see people, you know, talking about the device or talking about the tech in the video or about things that I talked about. And that's the kind of stuff that can help with furthering the next stuff.
For sure. What was the point, looking back, that you would say you saw the tide turn? Like you saw your subscriber count suddenly skyrocket. Press, you know, I mean, press has been pretty active for the last couple of years following your work, naming you the best technology reviewer on the planet, I think is one of the names of many that you've been given as far as, you know, how good you are at what you do. Is there a time looking back where you could say, man, that was really when things started to kind of go...
Yeah, I think So there's two things now that I think I have to point to. So the, as far as the growth of the channel and the viewership goes, it's always been like this curve. And there's no real spike where it just it's low, 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 and then suddenly it's high. I wish I could point to one video that I made where it's like there, that's when it got real. But there's sort of a benchmark of like when I upload, let's say I have 1,000 subscribers. When I upload that video in the first day, not all 1,000 people are going to log in and watch it in the first day. So I'm not expecting it to get 1,000 views. But I remember there's an announcement of like an Apple event and Safari, the browser, came to Windows. So I was on that laptop. I was like, oh, I'll make a video on how to download and install Safari and get it set up and work on Windows. So I made that video, slept on it overnight, woke up the next day, and it had something like 17,000 views. And at the time, I had a couple hundred subscribers. So that was a light bulb moment that like people really do care about like the timeliness of this information, and that it's really cool that that many people care about the thing that I just talked about, because I care about it too. So that many people got added to the people who have seen my videos. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is obviously Vic Gundotra, who's super highly respected, and a lot of people know about him and his work at Google, and him calling me the best tech reviewer on the planet was a different level of shout out, because it's not necessarily now a ton of people will subscribe on YouTube, but it's that sort of legitimacy of tech on YouTube in general, like the fact that it's a YouTuber that he's calling it the best tech reviewer on the planet, sort of gave a new spark to press looking at YouTube a little differently, and maybe traditional media trying to look over at what YouTubers are doing and learn a little bit from that. So I feel like we learned from each other, and I feel like that was a pretty valuable thing for him to say. So I'm constantly happy about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, to get a comment like that from somebody as well respected as Vic in that space. Yeah, you're right. It probably didn't directly relate into, you know, millions and millions of subscribers just right off that comment. But by legitimizing what you do on YouTube and, you know, the fact that you do it well, that opened you up to a lot of exposure in a lot of other places. There was another event that happened, and I remember this, I'm sure, and I know you do too, because I think it's your most popular video. It was the 4.7-inch iPhone 6 Sapphire Glass video. Can you tell me a little bit about how that happened, like kind of the backstory around that, how that video came about and what happened?
Right, yeah. So that was when, it was before that iPhone came out. So it was before, I guess, the iPhone 6, when there is, you know, parts leaking and parts coming out and people trying to speculate, obviously, what that new generation of phone is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And of course, what features it may have. So I remember Sonny Dixon hit me up and he was like, so yeah, this is the screen for it. If you want one, let me know. Got in touch with him and got that Sapphire Glass display. And I think he basically just told me like, here, just try to destroy it. And I was like, are you sure? Like, is it really that durable? And he was like, yeah, just try to destroy it. So I'd done videos in the past. I'd done scratch test videos in the past. I did one with an LG phone that's supposed to have a self-healing back. So people actually care about durability of phones. So I went out and I did try to scratch it, and it held up pretty well. So a lot of people took that to be like a pretty important new feature of the iPhone's display. And I guess that helped a lot. I made a follow-up video about it, detailing the hardness scale and how it works and why it's stronger than others. But yeah, a lot of press. I mean, that it got so many views. It was on websites everywhere. It was on news, TV channels and things like that. So that's definitely one of the videos that a lot of people have seen.
I almost feel like the Vic comment legitimized you in the press. This video got so much press that it legitimized you in the eyes of people who never knew who you were or that you could find this sort of stuff on YouTube. And I'm sure a video like that probably resulted in a lot of subscribes. Right. I have to imagine. Do you get random kind of tips a lot? Like, you cover a lot of technology. I know that you buy a lot of the technology that you review. I'm sure that you probably, you know, get review units, as we all do to a certain degree, you know, to review on the shows that we do. Do you ever get like kind of, hey, I got this piece of information, or, you know, kind of like this, like you probably were not meant to get that glass, glass from the iPhone. Does that happen a lot?
A little bit. And I don't really know the relative amount of tips I get versus how much others get. So yeah, once in a while, someone will give me some tip or some exclusive information and I can choose to share it or not. I usually don't, though. Like, I don't even know if I should say the last one I got, but it was really helpful to know for my own personal purchase decision on something. And then I just took it, like, as someone who just gave me some information. It was like a friend telling a friend something that he right. found out. And it's like, oh, good to know. Right. And now we both know. And we'll just kind of go from there. So I haven't gotten any, like, huge, like, massive leak of something that no one was ever meant to know that could, like, ruin some company or make some company fame. I don't even know. But, yeah, I've gotten some smaller stuff that's been really useful. But I guess that's about it.
That'd be a lot of pressure to have some sort of, you know, special information that you know could make or break a company. I don't know how I'd feel under that. I'd probably choose to just not do anything with it myself. How much of what you do is a one-man show? I mean, you've got an insane amount of technology. Obviously, you're in front of the camera for everything that you do. You're organizing this equipment in order to, you know, kind of keep the review train going. You've just moved into the studio. What we see in the backdrop, the background here is a studio that you're building out. It looks really darn close to being done. I mean, up until now, you were in a bedroom, essentially. You were facing different corners of the bedroom to kind of keep the views fresh and everything. And now you've got this whole playground to play in. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what my question was there, but.
Yeah, no, it's that this, having this space is a lot more useful. So what I guess you said, is it a one-man show?
Yeah,
pretty much everything.
There we go.
Yeah, 99% of what you see on the channel is just from what I'm making. That's just the way it's been since the beginning. Having a space like this obviously makes it really, I think this would be a good time, especially for me to add maybe one or two people to take care of the tedious everyday things that aren't part of making the videos or necessarily that I don't want to do every time. The weird part is that I enjoy so much of that process. Like, someone's like, oh, you should just, you know, hire someone to edit the videos so that you don't have to do that anymore. But I like editing videos. Like, that's a huge part of this channel and that's why I do it. So I love to do that. Have someone, you know, write the videos, have someone do these things. From point A to point Z, I kind of enjoy the video making process. So if anything, adding someone would be like, here's the keys to the inbox. Just go handle that today or something like that. But yeah, the studio and the different angles and the space and just in general, now that I'm graduated, having more opportunities to go out during the day or to go to events or to find new locations or things to make videos about makes a big difference. So it's a lot more fun.
Yeah, not to mention, I mean, when you're so intrinsically involved as you have been from the beginning with the content, with the delivery, you know, producing what you say on the screen, producing the video, editing it all, you're putting your own signature on all of that. And it turns out that signature has been incredibly successful. So I have to imagine the thought of bringing someone in to kind of maybe, you know, potentially take some of that off your shoulders. There's a little pressure involved in that because you don't really know, like, is that going to translate? Does that keep the magic that has brought you to this point if you do that?
Right. Yeah. It would be a big decision of, like, what, not only who the person is, but how much or what I would want them to do. If I want them to, hey, just come in here and focus the camera and frame it and you're done, bye, go home for the day. Or if they're like fully involved and they're like helping production and lights and they're helping with the inbox and behind the scenes and all this sort of stuff, it would likely be a combination of all of that. But yeah, it's kind of like a question of how integrated that new person would be.
Well, with all of that huge equipment that you're hauling around, I'm sure you could probably use a Sherpa of some sort, someone to help you kind of carry it all around, because it's quite a bit of stuff. And honestly, like, I would imagine there would be people jumping at the opportunity because then they end up learning kind of from someone who's really successful at it. So there's a big amount of value there. So you just mentioned that you were going to school and you just graduated. So you were going to university. You majored and you minored. What were those again? I know it was in complementary field.
Yeah, my major was business and technology.
There we go.
And I went to Stevens Tech in Hoboken, and they had what they call a concentration, which is essentially a minor. And I had two, one in marketing and communications and the other in information systems. So IT, business, tech, just kind of all wrapped into one.
Wrapped into a big sandwich, which, I mean, is like exactly what you do. That can only strengthen what you're doing right now. You were going to school concurrently with all of this craziness happening, obviously. How much, if at all, did kind of your online life and your campus life intersect, or were they pretty much completely separate?
I tried to keep them separate.
Yeah.
That's pretty much, yeah, I go to class. I mean, there's occasionally a class that like directly, like I had a class called, I'm pretty sure it was called like social media or something like that. Or like in the class, we were literally learning about Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to learn about this stuff and I'll be able to apply it to real life. But like time management wise, like it was always separate. So I would go to class, I have class hours, and when I'm done with class, I'm done with homework, then I'm full on YouTube video mode, and I have the morning hours for Ultimate Frisbee and the weekends for Frisbee. So like they were all separate in terms of their own time banks. But yeah, it was kind of nice that there were instances where I could directly relate things that I'm seeing in class to what I'm observing in real life.
Right, right. Now, talking about YouTube a little bit here, at what point along the way did you begin to kind of foster a relationship, let's say, if that's the right word, with YouTube beyond that of like just another guy on the network? I have to imagine, I mean, you're considered one of the more successful faces on YouTube. You know the drill. I have to imagine there's a little bit of synergy there between you and the folks that create the platform.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. A lot of like lately I've been helping where they're testing new features and things they want to consider adding. So they're asking YouTubers beforehand what they think of them, because that matters a lot to people who are making videos. And then they'll also ask for feedback of what we want, and they'll try to help us out and make those things happen. So lately there's been a couple things like that where they're literally asking us what we think of things before they make the choices. So yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Awesome. And you've gotten to know other kind of, I don't know if career YouTubers is the right right terminology, but people who make a pretty great living being on YouTube. What would you say is the general feeling about YouTube, like as a platform around which to base a career? Are they supportive of that?
I think the number one question people usually have about YouTube as a career is what happens when YouTube disappears.
Right.
So if YouTube is gone, like right now, what are you doing? What happens? My answer to that has always been like, I don't necessarily tie myself to YouTube, but if I'm doing online video about tech, which is to help people buy things and to make purchase decisions, if you know the answer to the question, where do you go to watch a video about the new phone? The answer to that, I'll just go to YouTube and type in iPhone and find the videos that are about it. If the answer to that question changes, I'll go to this other website, then I'll go over there too. If the answer is I'll go to Facebook Video or whatever, I don't even know what the answer after it is, if it's Vimeo or whatever. But if that answer changes, I'll gladly move to that, and I'm sure I can continue doing what I'm doing as long as it's proven that there will be an audience who will watch it.
Right.
So yeah, I guess YouTube as a career is in itself pretty limited, but I think web video is a much bigger thing that you can carry and move from platform to platform and share with people no matter what.
And yeah, and YouTube has been instrumental in kind of taking it to that next level, but now more than ever, video online is just, it's exploded. Everyone. So thankfully you have a lot of avenues as far as that's concerned. Now, you graduated last year. And then it was at that point that you dedicated yourself to the work that you're doing right now. And now we've got some time, the dust settled a little bit. You're obviously moving into the studio, so I have to imagine that's one big change. What are some other ways that your life is different now that you can kind of focus on this?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was in, I guess a big limiting part of when I'm going to school is I was also living in that city. So I was living in Hoboken. So I was in that apartment. So I didn't have a garage or anything like that. I'm just in this apartment, walking to class and back every day. So I've since moved out of there. So I have a place now with a garage so I can move between where I live and here, which is where I work. So that's like a pretty big change that I go to work instead of rolling out of bed and I'm at work. I get to spend a little more time on Ultimate and Ultimate related things. So that means practices and workouts and all the mini and leagues and things like that we're doing. I get to coach a little bit. I get to do clinics. And then, I get to spend more time thinking about how to do video. And I guess the dust is still kind of settling because I'm not fully in stride as far as like video content schedule, like constant one after the other stuff, but it's pretty close. So I feel like in the next couple of weeks, it'll be fairly regular, like back to the frequency it was before. And it's going to be a lot easier to have different scenery and just have it be better than it was before.
Do you have like a target that you shoot for as far as like number of videos that you're putting out, or is it just kind of like they happen, when the content, the time is ready?
Yeah, they're just kind of done when they're done, and then they go live. That's always why it seems to be at a weird hour when I'm uploading.
Yeah,
you might have that. Like when I tweet, like, all right, here it is, it's uploading. It's like, why are you uploading at 11 p.m.? It's like, because I finished it at 10:45, so here it is. But yeah, I guess I try to stick to, I would like to upload, at this point it's like 2 videos a week, maybe 3 sometimes if it's a busy week. There's a lot of technology, you know, it's quarter 3, quarter 4, there's a lot of stuff happening. But it's like every couple days, pretty much.
Yeah. And I should just throw this in there because, you know, these are some impressive names. You had the chance to interview Kobe Bryant. I have to imagine that was awesome because I know you're a basketball fan.
That was awesome.
What did you think of that experience?
That was unreal. The dude is so good. I mean, we don't think about like people being good at being interviewed.
Yeah.
But he's been interviewed because he's been a stud in that scene for 20 years. So he was really good at making me look like a better interviewer. I thought it was a terrible interview, but he made it really good because he's good at talking about whatever. So he made it a lot of fun. And of course, it's awesome to meet a legend in person. So that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Not only that, you were interviewed by Neil deGrasse Tyson a couple of months ago. I think this was like back in March, which was a fascinating interview. He seems like a really cool dude to talk with as well. I mean, he's just got like a sparkle to him. You know what I mean?
It's true. He has the charisma, and you see it in videos. But like when he walks in a room, because I was there and I was a little early and he was a little late, so I was like waiting for him.
Yeah.
As soon as the dude walks in the room, everyone in the room is best friends with him. Like he's immediately super, super fun to talk to. He's like the uncle that you can talk to about anything. He's been around. He knows what's good.
Yeah.
It helps that he's into physics and science and technology. So that's kind of what we talked about, and that was fun. But I'm sure you could talk to him about anything and it would be fun.
Yeah, probably so. And then very recently, well, I guess this was January, you got to ask a question during the Democratic debates televised. Right. You were one of 4 YouTubers who had the opportunity to do this. Your question focused on encryption technology. Did they reach out to you for that? Or was there like some way that you could get involved I don't know. How did you get involved?
Yeah, they did reach out. So the YouTube team and a couple of people that I've worked with at YouTube reached out to me that they were considering, you know, having this YouTube format injected into the debate. And when they were deciding they were going to do it, they were like, all right, who do we want to ask questions? They had a tech-related YouTuber. I picked a couple. That wasn't the only question that I framed. We shot like 3 or 4 questions to be ready in case they talked about other things at the debate. But I shot some tech-related questions. And they ended up using it, and it was awesome.
Were you satisfied with the answer that they gave?
I don't know if I can say I was. I think only one of the candidates, I think just one, ended up answering it. And it was kind of like, I agree type of answer. But I would have liked to have – I'm sure if I asked them again tonight, they would have a lot more to say. But, yeah, it was still pretty cool to see it happen.
For sure. So we're kind of rounding near the end, which is kind of like where I want to kind of touch on, where you go from here. What's your secret sauce? Why do you think your videos continue to resonate as much as they do? People obviously can't get enough, and your subscriber count keeps going up. You're putting out amazing content. How do you do it? What's your formula?
I don't know. I'd like to say it's the fact that, I mean, obviously lots of people do videos about tech.
Yeah.
So you'd have the criteria number one is people are interested in tech. And then among all the tech personalities and channels to watch content from, maybe you find a personality particularly relatable. I'm 22, maybe younger. If you're a younger person, you'll watch a younger person's perspective better. Maybe that will help.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know if it's about being relatable or if it's just that the content evolves and it's fun to watch. Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's, if you're trying to think of a way to have a unique way to stand out, it's just having like my secret sauce, which isn't a secret, is that I'm trying to make the best quality videos I can. But everything past that is just a result of the passion I have for tech, and hopefully that shines through and it's fun to watch and it's enjoyable.
How do you keep that momentum going? I mean, you know, it's obviously sometimes I feel like content on the internet is like a hamster wheel and we're just a hamster running on the wheel and yay, we got the food and now on to the next one. How do you keep that momentum? I mean, it takes a lot of energy, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting because this is one of those unique places on YouTube in this little genre, this little bubble of tech where the content just kind of makes itself in a way. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a vlogger, you vlog your life every day, you kind of have to make decisions to keep your life interesting and make the vlog interesting. And there's other genres as well. But with tech, there's going to be a new phone every year. There's going to be new tablets every year. There's going to be self-driving cars. There's just so many things that are constantly happening. So as long as tech is a hamster wheel of things trying to get better, then I guess YouTube and videos about tech and maybe just tech press in general is just going to keep revolving like that also.
Yeah.
And I don't see myself burning out because I enjoy tech. I've always enjoyed tech. So whether the style changes or whatever to keep me entertained, that might be fun. But I feel like it's as long as tech is interesting,
right?
The videos about tech will be too.
That's the thing about technology. It's always interesting because it's always cutting edge. It's always like about the next thing. Do you enjoy living such a public life? Do you ever wish that you didn't?
I actually feel like I have a pretty good balance of like the public, the things that are public versus the things that I want to keep as my own life. So like obviously the people constantly asking, oh, what phone do you use right now? What tech advice do you have for me? That kind of stuff that's public. I get that. That's fine. I'm the person that you ask if you need me to fix your printer. Yes, grandma, I'll fix your printer. I get it. But yeah, as far as like, you know, going out of state to go play Ultimate Frisbee or going walking to the mailbox to go mail something, like that's fine. I don't really have any problems with that. So that's cool. So I feel like it's a healthy balance.
Yeah, good. And I think that's really important for longevity. And then final question, I think you kind of started down this, but I'm curious to know kind of the solid answer. I know you love video and it's obvious that you love video and that you want to do this for a long time. Where are you 10 years from now? Do you envision a life that evolves from tech focused videos on YouTube and into other things? Or is it even possible to even like have a vision of what 10 years from now is? Like, where does this evolve to?
Yeah, that's the thing about tech is it's just as hard of a question to answer. Like, am I still covering tech in 10 years or is it this totally other world? I see myself talking about it in some capacity. I never really, because 10 years is so long. Yeah. If you ask me 5 years, I could say, yeah, I'll probably still in 5 years be involved with making videos about tech in some way. But as far as an evolution of that, it's just kind of whatever I'm interested in. It's kind of given me that freedom of production to just talk about whatever seems to be interesting. And hopefully there's still an audience that also finds that stuff interesting.
Right.
But yeah, it's just a constant hamster wheel, I guess.
Yep. Wherever it takes you. Awesome.
Yeah.
Marquez Brownlee, such a pleasure getting the chance to sit down with you for an hour and pick your brain and kind of figure out your path and just wish you nothing but success, which I don't even need to wish you that because you've already got it. But you're doing an awesome job. Everybody, you know, in the tech sphere especially, is really interested in your videos, man. And you're hitting the nail on the head repeatedly. So it's an honor to get to talk to you about it.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So youtube.com/MKBHD, basically MKBHD all across the map. If you want to find Marquez Brownlee on the internet, it's pretty easy to do nowadays. best of luck with your studio. And I can't wait to see kind of like the final product and what we get to see, different angles, different corners. I imagine you're going to use all that space.
Absolutely. For
right
sure. On.
All right. Have a great day, Marquez. It's been an honor.
Same to you.
All right. Take care, man. We record Triangulation. Well, actually, Leo normally records Triangulation every Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, 1800 UTC. Just got to go to twit.tv/live to catch it for the live recording. And then, of course, later in the afternoon, it publishes for those of you who don't catch it live at twit.tv/triangulation. That is it. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion with Marquez Brownlee. I know I have. And I'm looking forward to the next episode of Triangulation. We'll see y'all next week. Bye, everybody.